Good afternoon and welcome to your own health and fitness. I'm health integrationist Lena Berman. I come to you weekly to discuss self-care and integrated health. You've all heard about apparently healthy individuals, relatively young, lean and athletic, having sudden massive heart attacks. They may have had heart disease in their families, and you wonder if even doing everything right can protect someone like that. You never hear what it is in their family line that caused a sudden heart attack in someone so young. Well, there are several factors that can run in families, but heart disease can also pop up in people who don't take care of themselves in particular ways that are not obvious. I'm talking about clotting, C-L-O-T-T-I-N-G, clotting factors, and specifically today, one that involves a very particular type of very small particle, LDL cholesterol. This type of cholesterol can be an inherited trait, but it's also found in type 2 diabetics and people with insulin resistance, which you've heard me talk about before. I'm joined today by journalist Matthew Bayon, author of Eat Fat, Be Healthy, Understanding the Heart Stopper Gene and Why a Low-Fat Diet Can Kill You. Matt Bayon has more than 25, actually by now almost 30 years experience managing nutrition and healthcare programs in the public and private sectors. Since his massive coronary, he's been at the forefront of experimental treatment for the genetic defect he's named the heart stopper effect. He lives with his wife in Reno, Nevada, and we welcome him today. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Lena. How are you doing?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm very well.
Yeah, I know you are. We're going to find out why you're so well. I interviewed you back in 2000, and we kind of told your whole story. And some people may have heard that show, but I think most people have not. I think it's important maybe to open the show by explaining what exactly happened to you. I mean, as I said in the intro, you were a very apparently... even had just had a physical, which gave you a completely marvelous bill of health. You'd had a stress test, and your heart had been checked out. You were, what, 46?
45.
45. And something awful happened. Why don't you tell people what happened?
Sure. Let me give you the background of my pretty wild story. I was 45 years old. At the time, I mean, people can't see me, but visualize a 6'2 guy who's thin. I exercised every day. I took care of myself. I thought I was eating a very good diet. I was working at the time as the bureau chief for the Iowa Department of Health Nutrition Bureau. I had nutritionists working for me. I mean, we talked about food and nutrition all the time. So I thought I had a good diet. I exercised. I thought I was in great shape. And whammo, I wake up in the middle of the night literally dying. And I went into cardiac arrest, fortunately, after I got to the hospital. And there I broke some great world record. My heart stopped 72 times, and I was brought back to life 72 times, which had never been done before.
Well, and you might explain that there was a reason why the doctor kept doing it, because most doctors would not have bothered.
Well, in fact, he said that afterwards. I asked him why he continued to revive me. And I said, you know, do you normally do this? He said, no. If you had been older, if you'd been like 65 years old, I would have given up after maybe 12 or 15 times. But looking at you, what he said was, I looked at you, he said, you just look too young for this to be happening. And as long as your heart kept coming back, I was going to keep doing this all night long if I had to. And fortunately for me, he was that persistent, or I wouldn't be here.
So one of the things that it might be helpful to explain also is that you lost your father to a massive coronary, and he was pretty young as well.
Well, he was 50, and he died of his first heart attack. It wasn't until after I had a heart attack that I began kind of investigating into my family, and I found some rather shocking information. My grandfather had died of a heart attack. His two brothers had died of a heart attack. My father's two or three cousins.
Okay, it sounds like we may have lost Matt Bayon. Why don't we put a little music on, and then the gentleman who's working the board at KPFA, why don't you let us know when you've got Matt back? Actually, you know what? Instead of putting music, why don't I just talk a little bit until we get Matt back, until he redials his number. As I said, we interviewed Matt in the year 2000, and one of the things that's really interesting about the story is that what he's explaining is that there's a long family history of heart disease, and all of these people who had these massive heart attacks at a young age. So one of the things we're learning from this experience of hearing his story, which is going to relate to other types of unusual clotting factors, you know, some of the other clotting factors, this one is about a type of a very small particle LDL cholesterol that's so small that when the HDL cholesterol goes through to clean out the arteries after the placement, cholesterol comes in when there's inflammation, and LDL comes in and carries antioxidants and things into an area. You have to have it. It's important. But you can have a genetic trait that gives you this very small particle LDL. So when the HDL, which is, they call this the good cholesterol because it comes in and scrubs out the LDL. It's the one that removes the cholesterol, moves it through. This very small particle stuff gets a little bit, can be missed, and then a piece of it will break off and the body will form a clot around
Matthew
it.
Matthew Bayon is back on the
Thank
air.
You. Matt, you there?
Hi, yes. If I seem to eat that.
Huh? You what?
If I seem to eat that. I was sent somewhere. I don't know where.
Well, you know, you have to stop that, you know. I mean, do we have to get the paddles out? I was explaining that just very kind of crudely what this small particle LDL is. But you were explaining that you had all these family members with these heart attacks, and it seems very important for people to know their family history, because when you see this pattern, I've had people come into my practice who at a very early age suddenly have a heart incident, and there's nothing that they're presenting that sounds like heart disease. So when that's happening, you don't just throw your hands up and say, oh, too bad, you know, you go on a witch hunt. And what we're learning now is that there are a variety of these things. We've also been hearing more about homocysteine. This can be another one that causes an early heart attack in people for no apparent reason. So anyway, but small particle LDL, as I explained, is this, you know, these really small pieces that don't get scrubbed out by the HDL, and then you form a clot around it. So in fact, you, as I recall, did have some symptoms before the incident, but what you said was that the symptoms were so odd that they weren't obviously heart symptoms.
No, and I caution people about the fact that you really have to take care of yourself. You have to take responsibility, because if you treat your body like it's your car and you take it to the mechanic and you drop it off at 8 in the morning and you say, I'll pick it up at 5 and I want everything fixed, if you take that attitude, you won't catch this stuff. You'll wind up dead. Fortunately for me, I squeaked through, but as you said, 5 weeks before I had my heart attack, I had some weird feeling in my chest, stomach area. It wasn't pain, it was just kind of a weird something that I'd never felt before. So I went to the hospital, and it kept me overnight, and that's when they ran all the tests that you can possibly do to determine whether someone has heart disease or had a heart attack. You know, they do blood enzymes, they do EKG, they do a stress echocardiogram. I mean, they did everything. And I think the fact that I looked healthy and young and thin worked against me. If I'd been a big fat guy, they might have looked more closely at me. But the fact that I looked healthy, they concluded that I had acid reflux.
Yeah, or panic attack.
Yeah,
or
so here I am taking my Lanta, while meanwhile my heart's getting ready to fail on me.
I think you once described the feeling in your heart as a hollow feeling. Is that what you said?
No, it was sort of a twitching feeling.
Twitching.
It was like the muscles, it was as if I was having an electrical charge through my chest, and it was like my muscles were twitching. And I know now that that was a form of unstable angina.
Right.
Which very frequently results in a heart attack within 6 weeks. Mm. And I was right on schedule.
You know, after we did the show the last time, I had a whole bunch of people come in that were really panicked about getting a heart attack, you know, and they were like, every time they felt a twinge, they were panicking. So one of the things we're saying here is not, We're not saying just any time you feel, because you can have a twinge or a pain or even a twitchy feeling in the muscles that attach to your sternum, in your pectoral muscles. Sometimes people come in, they think they're having heart pain, and it's a pectoral muscle, because you'll even feel that in your neck and down your arm, the way a heart thing is. Although having a pressure, feeling a pressure on the chest and then having it radiate down can be ominous, or nausea and stuff. So, you know, I think what we're saying here is that you didn't realize this, but you had a very ominous family history. And that's when you want to pay close attention to the heart. Is not to say that you should ignore the heart the rest of the time, but that's when even being a runner and being lean might not protect you, you know.
Well, one of the things that shocked me, I've talked to many, many doctors and researchers over the past several years because of, you know, my desire to stay as healthy as possible. And one of the things that absolutely blew me away was talking to a doctor, a cardiologist, who does autopsies. And he said, you know, I've looked at marathon runners. He said, you know, every time there's a major marathon, somebody dies. They just don't show it on television.
Wow.
And he's done many of the autopsies for these folks. And he said, you wouldn't believe it. Here are men who are thin, young. They run 20, 30 miles a day, and their arteries are closed down.
Yeah.
Now, there's something else going on, obviously.
Yes.
Which doesn't fit into the traditional paradigm about heart disease.
Well, the traditional paradigm about heart disease is beginning to be exploded. It's just taking a long time for it to happen. But there's another thing I want to say about this marathon stuff, which is that there was also a study done. This is one of those really intuitive things. And it was a study on longevity. And what they showed is that when people exercise moderately or even fairly intensely, but with a lot of rest and a lot of recovery built in, it can prolong their lives a few years. You know, it can actually make a difference. But when people exercise in an extremely intense way, just, you know, really intensely, sometimes that can be such a stressor that it will cause stress-related illness. And heart disease can be a stress-related illness.
Sure. Because,
you know. So, you know, I don't want to, like, keep people dangling. I want to go back to some of the things that you had in the hospital experience and some of that, because there's instructions in there on how to, you know, like, for instance, just before we go on, actually, why not say this? It's very important. You learned this. You don't, if you're in the hospital, you have to make some kind of arrangement with somebody to come and be there with you. Because one of the things that happened is that you woke up and you'd been given a medication which paralyzed you, and nobody told you, and nobody noticed you were awake, and you had this tube down your... Well, you should explain. And it was your girlfriend that got, and now wife, that Bev, who helped.
Well, I mean, I seem to have had a series of bizarre incidents. It's kind of like there's this chain of risky events that I somehow got through. If any one of them had broken, I wouldn't have made it. But, you know, I woke up from the heart attack, and at the time, I was not even sure I had had a heart attack. I mean, I thought that might be it, but, you know, I wake up several hours later, I'm very disoriented, groggy, and I've got a tube down my throat, so I can't talk. And I'm laying there, and I know there are people around me, because I can hear them, and they're puttering around, and they're doing things, and they're playing with tubes and all kinds of things, and nobody knows I'm awake. And I lay there for at least an hour, with this building sense of absolute panic, thinking that maybe I had a stroke, thinking that maybe I'm a vegetable now, maybe I'm paralyzed for life, because I couldn't move anything except my eyelids. And I was absolutely just terrorized. And this went on for a long time before somebody, one of the nurses, finally saw that I was blinking my eyes. And it took quite a while for them to recognize that I was trying to answer their questions by blinking once for yes and twice for no. You would think they'd know these things. And even after several hours had gone by, slowly but surely I began to get some ability to move. It took a long time before anybody finally told me that I had been given a drug to paralyze me during my heart attack because of the seizures that I was having. I was flopping all over the place. And this is standard practice. They give you a drug that paralyzes you so you don't hurt yourself or disrupt the procedure. Well, I didn't know that. And so it seemed to me that I found so many little niches in the hospital where mistakes were made that resulted in either panic for me or something unnecessary
which,
done.
And panic could have given you another heart attack,
sure.
too. But the other thing is that they wouldn't get rid of this tube in your chest, and you knew you were drowning, and they didn't get it, and finally it was Bev, I've met Bev, and she's very luminous and soft-spoken, and she finally just went to the front desk and started screaming at them, so they finally took it out. But they kept thinking, no, it has to be there, you know, and all this, and it was all wrong. So it's very important to have somebody in the hospital when you're there, to have even a friend come and be with you. I just want to let people know where they are. This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm doing a show on the phone with Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, Matthew Bayan. His book is Eat Fat, Be Healthy, Understanding the Heart Stopper Gene and When a Low-Fat Diet Can Kill You. It's published by Scribner. And we're talking about his experience with small particle LDL. We probably should just cut to the chase. Why is it that low-fat diets don't work for this heart problem?
Well, we probably should set a little bit of a stage here.
Okay.
I've, over the past several years now, since I've been doing so much research in order to stay alive, really, literally, I have found a number of major myths that people believe, doctors believe, the public believes, which are actually to our detriment. One of them is about low-fat diets. If you have a heart attack or you have a heart operation or anything related to cardiac health, standard practice is to put you on a low-fat diet. The other standard practice is to put you on a drug called statin, which is a cholesterol-reducing drug. Things like Lipitor, Zocor, Pravacol, these are statin drugs. And it's believed that that should be done for everybody. Well, these two things are wrong. They're right for some people, but wrong for other people. And my problem is that up to this point, there's no strong effort to figure all this out and to determine who's who. Up to this point, most doctors have considered heart disease to be one disease. It's not. There are many different flavors of heart disease. And just for the sake of discussion, there are probably 7 or 8 major causes of heart disease that have to do with blood chemistry, that have to do with cholesterol. And they're very different. You were describing earlier small particle LDL syndrome. Well, you can either inherit that or you can actually trigger it,
right,
depending upon whether you might have diabetes or insulin resistance, or you may get overweight and not exercise. You can trigger it by a number of things. One of those things that's a trigger is a low-fat diet. There have been some major studies done that show that for about 30 to 40% of the population, if you put them on a low-fat diet, the body will begin to produce these small particle LDL forms of cholesterol, which are very dangerous. They immediately triple your heart attack risk.
Yeah, the other little key that this is going on is you see the triglycerides, which are a blood fat that is usually created from too many carbohydrates, but it's a blood fat sure as you're sitting there, you know. It's a blood fat, and you know, the range in most blood tests is up to 200, which is, I think, too high already. If you see it go above 100, you should be sort of noticing that. And I've had people in my office with triglyceride levels of 600, and that's extremely dangerous. And ironically, one of them came back because he did have a heart attack. I said, this has to get down. You're on a vegetarian diet, and it's not working for you. Some people can do this. You're not one of them. Too many carbohydrates. And then what you've pointed out is when you see the LDL and the triglycerides both elevated, and there's a family history of heart disease, that's ominous. That should be pursued.
And particularly if you're on a low-fat diet already.
Yep.
I've talked to many patients who have emailed me or called me who tell me about how they have gone on an extremely low-fat diet, they've begun exercising, they start losing weight, and yet their triglycerides don't seem to drop very much, their LDL does not seem to drop, and they don't see a corresponding increase in their HDL. That's a real red flag. The problem is that it's difficult to diagnose from the lipid panel. The lipid panel is extremely inaccurate. Just to give you an idea, anybody who's dealt with medicine has heard of the Framingham study, which is the longest, largest medical study ongoing in the United States.
Yeah, we just talked about it in the last show. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, perfect. So you've set the stage.
Yeah.
The Framingham data shows that for people who have already been diagnosed with heart disease, they've either had a heart attack or some other event, 4 out of 5 of them do not have high cholesterol. 4 out of 5 of them look normal when you look at the lipid panel. Well, this is pretty disastrous when you consider that, you know, you're going to find only 1 out of 5 people. You can only find those who have the very worst kind of cholesterol profile. But what about the rest? 4 out of 5 people are going to go right through that test and not be caught. And that's a huge danger. And I see diagnosis as one of the biggest weaknesses that we have in terms of treating heart disease. And it's probably why heart disease will kill half the people listening to this show. So that's the first step. The first problem is diagnosing whether you have some kind of cholesterol problem.
No, and let me back up and say that what we're saying is not just overall cholesterol numbers.
Yeah.
What we're talking about, because, you know, there was a study that I cited in last week's show that showed that elderly adults over 65, that they the ones that lived the longest were the ones with the highest cholesterol levels, even the ones that had high LDL.
Mm-hmm.
The difference was if they had corresponding high glucose levels, if there was, or triglycerides. If there was evidence of insulin resistance or sugar problems, then the high cholesterol and the high LDL was dangerous. In the other people, the high cholesterol and the high having a bad ratio even didn't predict morbidity. They didn't die. They were very long-lived. So,
well, there's another thing working here. Let me explain why the lipid panel is not a very good predictor of either having heart disease or not having heart disease. It's not the levels of cholesterol. It's not the levels of HDL and LDL that are important. Those are very gross numbers. You need to break those down even further. And there are tests now, fortunately, in the past 5 or 6 years that can do that. I'll give you an example. Let's just take LDL. Now, everyone considers that the bad cholesterol. Now, imagine hundreds of different particles that make up LDL that are classified as LDL, which is low-density lipoprotein. So you have all these different low-density particles. Imagine a grapefruit, an orange, and a lemon. They're all citrus fruits, but they taste very differently. They have different colors, different size. Imagine that the grapefruit is the larger particles of LDL and the lemon is the smallest particles of LDL. Most people don't produce very many of the lemons, but some people do. A low-fat diet could trigger it, or it could be genetic, as in my case, where you produce many more of the lemons than the grapefruits. And it's those small particles that are the most dangerous. Now, when you get a lipid panel done, it is counting the oranges, the lemons, and the grapefruits all as LDL, and you get a number. Let's say the number is 140 or 120, and you think, well, that's pretty good. That's within the normal range. But what if among that 120, that total count, what if most of the particles are lemons? You're in serious trouble. But the test does not show you that. It only shows you that you've got a count of 120, and most doctors would say that's fine. So that's the problem. There are tests now called expanded cholesterol tests, which go beyond the lipid panel. They break down the particles into subcomponents so that you can see whether you've got a lot of lemons or grapefruits or oranges, how dangerous your blood profile really is. This kind of testing, if I had had it 6 years ago, I wouldn't have had a heart attack. And it's this kind of testing that I now use to monitor how my body is responding to a diet, to medication, to exercise, to make sure that I stay in the sweet spot and don't increase my risk for a heart attack.
The expanded cholesterol test, is that something that is now known enough so that somebody can go to their doctor and say, well, look, you know, this is interesting. I have a high LDL and a high triglyceride, and I'm nervous about this. There's heart disease in my family. Can we do an expanded cholesterol test? Will the doctor have any way of figuring out where to go for that? Is there only a certain lab that the blood has to be sent to? Is there a specific way the blood has to be tubed and topped and handled?
Well, the simple answer is no. Most doctors don't know about it. They depend on the lipid panel. That's the gold standard. And even though it's very inaccurate, they don't know it's inaccurate. So what I normally recommend to patients going to talk to their doctor is mention the test. If they don't know about it, then you need to get them to order one, and maybe you have to do it yourself even in order to get the proper test. And to answer your other question, there are only a couple of labs in the whole country that do this testing, but they all do it the same way. You go to the doctor, they get a blood test, they order a kit from the laboratory with special bottles, etc., They package it up. The doctor ships it off by Federal Express, and then the lab does the testing. So literally anybody in the country anywhere can get this testing done. They don't have to have the laboratory in their own town. And that's one of the reasons that the lipid panel is so popular, because every hospital lab can do it. Every local laboratory can do it, so it's cheap and easy, and people say, well, this is what I'm going to use. But it's really not the... It's not what should be the gold standard. The technology has gone beyond the lipid panel.
So can you share with us which labs are doing this so that a person can actually make it easy for the doctor to find it?
Sure.
Okay.
First of all, if you go to my website, I've got links.
Okay.
And that's eatfatbehealthy.com.
And that's all one word, yep. eatfatbehealthy.com.
Right, no punctuation, eatfatbehealthy.com. Or I can tell you about some of the labs. There are, one that I use is called Atherotech.
You want to spell that?
It's A-T-H-E-R-O-T-E-C-H, Atherotech. And if you just have your doctor call this 800 number, it's 800-719-9807.
You're going to have to do that again because everybody just scrambled.
Sure. People just crashed on the highway trying to find the
people. Yeah, piece of paper, right.
Okay, 800-719-9807. And you would just ask your doctor to request a VAP, expanded cholesterol test. It's called VAP.
VAP,
mm-hmm.
Expanded cholesterol.
Right. And then the lab will send a kit out to the doctor. It's packed in a little styrofoam cube, and it's got everything that's needed in there.
Okay.
Most health plans will pay for this.
Yeah.
Because it's blood work.
Yeah.
And even if they don't, it's only $130.
Oh, that's not bad at all.
So I've had lots of people say, you know, that they do it just because they want to know.
Okay.
I strongly recommend that any adult get this testing just to see where you're at.
Do a baseline.
You do a baseline.
Yeah.
Now, if you're fine, you go on about your merry life and don't worry about it.
Well, you don't worry about small particle LDL. You still probably should be, people should still, if there's a family history, you still want to check for homocysteine, which is fairly common now. It's not so unusual, which is this, I don't actually want to do a whole thing on homocysteine, but it's another clotting factor. We also have lipoprotein A, that's capital L.
LP.
That's right. Capital L, capital P, small a. So that should be checked too. People can also have their fibrinogen checked. F-I-B-R-O-G-E-N, fibrinogen. And if they want to get fancy, it's good to do pro, P-R-O, thrombin, T-H-R-O-M-B-I-N, prothrombin time. So those are your coagulation factors. Those are good to check. Although it's good to know that those things all get crazy if you've got a virus or a cold. Because I had a big panel done, and I the day after they took the blood, it was so stressful to do this because I had a million things done at the same time. And I came down with a really bad flu the day after, so it looked like it was really, the numbers were really impressive.
You were like an alien.
Yeah, I was. That's right. I looked like an alien. You know, we have to take just a brief break. So we're doing a show. It's Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman. I'm on the phone with Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, Eat Fat, Be Healthy, Understanding the Heart Stopper Gene When a Low-Fat Diet Can Kill You. We're going to break for about 30 seconds, and then we'll be right back. Stay with us. Welcome back. How's that? Is that cheery for you all?
Death comes
cheery?
Once and is a tragedy. I love that song.
You like that? This is Your Own Health and Fitness. I'm Lena Berman, and I'm chatting away with Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, Eat Fat, Be Healthy, Understanding the Heart Stopper Gene, When a Low-Fat Diet Can Kill You. You can get the book. It's published by Scribner, or you can also... And you can also go to his website, eatfatbehealthy.com, with the requisite W's. If you missed parts of today's show and want to get a copy of this show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, I have cassettes only, no transcripts. You can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772, or you can go to my website, which is yourownhealthandfitness.com, yourownhealthandfitness.com.
Let's jump back to something.
Oh, good. I'm glad you had. I was going to go to diabetes, but you go ahead. You jump somewhere else.
You were talking about the various cholesterol forms that, or the lipid forms that need to be tested. One of the things I've really found very useful about the VAP test, that's the expanded cholesterol test, is it shows homocysteine, LP little.
Oh.
It shows all the forms of HDL and LDL, triglycerides, and I think I mentioned LP little A, yes. And homocysteine. So,
oh, that's terrific. So it does lipids and clotting factors, because homocysteine and lipoprotein A are sort of more coagulation factors.
Actually, lipoprotein A is almost...
George is shaking his head. Nope.
It's almost like a... it's almost LDL.
Really?
It's just slightly less dense than LDL.
Well, that's interesting. It's a lipoprotein, a lipid protein.
Right.
Uh-huh. Homocysteine, if people really want to read about homocysteine, you can get Kilmer McCulley's book, K-I-L-M-E-R, and then McCulley, I think, is M-C, I think it's M-C-C-U-L-L-E-L-Y, yeah. And it's called The Heart Revolution. And his story is very interesting because he discovered this, and everybody got very angry at him because he was saying cholesterol is not the only thing going on here. And he sort of got fired from Harvard or someplace like that. It was really icky. But he's very, very, very smart and lovely, and I'll have him on again. So, yeah, that's great that they expanded. I think I might get one. I think it's interesting to do that. Anybody who has heart disease in their family should look at these little, these different things, you know, instead of a broad swipe.
Well, I think even if you don't, I mean, let's look at some numbers. Right now, almost 50% of everybody in this country is going to die from heart disease. More people are killed by heart disease than any other disease. In fact, if you add up all the other diseases, heart disease kills more.
Really? Than cancer?
But 10 times more than cancer.
Jeez Louise.
So, you know, people seem to not be aware of that fact. So we go along in our lives and we don't think about it.
Well, and women don't think about it, too. I mean, there's been this mythology that if you take estrogen, your heart's protected.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true. Estrogen is a clotting factor. If your sex hormones are out of balance and you've got a lot of estrogen without progesterone and not enough testosterone, and you're a woman, you go through menopause that way, you're in trouble.
Right.
Yeah. And if you're overweight, and God, it's the obesity rates in this country are now, I mean, there's a real, and diabetes, you know, there is this true epidemic of diabetes going on right now. We all know this. We all have gotten used to seeing people who you didn't used to see on the streets. You know, they're morbidly obese, and it's terrible. I'm not being judgmental. I mean, I think people can live their lives however they choose, but it would be wrong to say that this doesn't have health consequences. There are some huge people who are absolutely incredibly healthy that can manage, but the numbers just, I mean, epidemiology is really a problem and stuff, the study, but just if you understand how the body works, you know that you're putting yourself at risk. It skews your hormones. It just puts you at risk for cancer and heart disease. And as I said, there are large people who are not at risk, who are healthy, who exercise, who eat well, but there's also an equal number who do not manage well.
But what's amazing is you can isolate who they are by doing an expanded cholesterol test.
That's one of the things
very
you can
frequently
do. Yeah.
Because I have a very good friend who's huge. He looks like two football players. And I had him do one of these expanded tests because I figured he was headed for trouble, and I talked him into it. Well, he has a fantastic blood profile.
Yeah.
He has...
His blood sugars are okay, too?
Everything's fine.
Oh.
I mean, he won't die of heart disease. He'll die of something else.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it just seems to me that it's important to start there because there are so many different varieties. You know, we've been focusing on LDL, but HDL is also a problem.
In what way?
Well, let's say you go to the doctors and you get, let's say your cholesterol is 190. That looks good. Your LDL is 100. That looks good. And your HDL is 65, which is considered very high. Anything above 40, 45 is considered high. You say, well, I'm fine. But here's the problem. Another variety of heart disease is caused by HDL that is not effective. It's not a scrubber. It doesn't clean out. Again, when you break your HDL down, you have different sized particles. Again, it's the larger particles that are the scrubbers. The smaller particles do nothing.
There's small particle HDL?
Yes.
Holy moly.
And large particle HDL. So they're broken down.
Uh-huh.
It's called HDL2, subfraction 2.
That would explain why, you know, because, you know, I've done various shows with, for the most famous one is Ufi Ravenskov, mm-hmm. Ravenskov. You've seen his book,
right.
The Cholesterol Myths, with an S at the end. He is a very eminent PhD, MD. From Europe, and he's gone through all of the studies about cholesterol. His cholesterol is very high, and he says, poo-poo, you know, there's no correlation between high cholesterol levels and heart disease. But what you're saying is, well, we know that there are some individuals who are susceptible. It isn't that simple. It isn't a simple thing like that, and that you should still look at the ratio. See, I tend not to be worried if people's cholesterol is high, if the ratios look good and they...
See, the ratio,
you know,
also is not...
Not important,
not
huh?
Because you could have a ratio that let's say you have a high amount of HDL and a low amount of LDL, the ratio would look very good. And you'd say, oh, this person looks fine. The problem is, it's again, how do you count? It's not the amount, it's what is the HDL and LDL composed of? Suppose the HDL, let's say it's 65, suppose it's composed mainly of small HDL particles, which do nothing, versus the larger particles, which are the scrubbers.
Yeah.
You can have a good number, good ratio,
and end up with a blockage.
Heart disease.
Yeah, you got a blockage. Well, you know, one thing that we should explain here is, first of all, this cholesterol thing is tricky too, because especially in women, when they stop menstruating, their cholesterol levels will jump up. Anyone where the sex hormones are starting to trend down, will, or if their thyroid is out of whack, will get cholesterol readings that are higher. And it isn't clear. I don't want people to think automatically if your cholesterol is above 200 that you're in trouble, because I don't think that's true. But it does make sense, I think, to get this expanded cholesterol. But, you know, I think what we need to do now, I want to go back to the diabetes connection, too, with the insulin and the cort and all that. But what we probably need to say is that there are interventions, just as with homocysteine, folic acid and trimethylglycine, you know, the B vitamins, B12, are protective. And then even if someone has a tendency to have high homocysteine, if they control by diet and by taking the right nutrients, they're protected. So, in other words, it isn't a ticket out of here if you find out that you've got one of these things. Otherwise, no one's going to get tested, you know.
No.
But there are ways to take care of yourself. So we should probably talk about some of that.
Well, let me focus on that. That's a very good point. Because here I am, 6 years after a major heart attack.
Yeah, and you lost a lot of heart muscle, too.
I lost 30% of my heart function, but I'm doing fine.
Yeah.
And I think I'm testimony to how well you can come back from this devastating situation. But even more so, I've completely turned around my blood chemistry to the point where I've gone against the common mythology, which is that you can slow heart disease down or maybe even stop it for a while, but it will eventually just continue to form blockages in your arteries. That's not true.
That's right.
I'm proof, and the doctors I've worked with know this, I'm proof that you can reverse heart disease. I had blockages which are now gone, and I attribute that to exercise and diet to some degree, but I really attribute the major shift in my blood chemistry to vitamin B3. Without taking any drugs...
Niacin,
is the most potent form of intervention that you can take for heart disease. And I've had many doctors say to me, I cannot believe the results that I'm getting with niacin. And what it does, very simply, is it kicks the liver, which produces most of your cholesterol, it kicks the liver into producing more of the scrubbing HDL, the large particle HDL, and it inhibits the production of the small LDL particles. So it's a double whammy. It does the two good things that you need. It lowers the small particle LDL and increases the large particle HDL. So you get more scrubbing and you get less of the blocking agents. I've seen the effect of that. After about 3 years, we had an angiogram done on me, and my blockages were gone. Now, that's pretty dramatic to go from being at high risk for a heart attack to really to be less than normal risk now for a heart attack.
Niacin is a tricky vitamin to take for a variety of reasons. The main reason is that people sometimes experience extremely uncomfortable flushing responses from it. And also, it's dose dependent. Not everybody will need the same amount, so right. It's this thing of finding the right dose. Do you have some suggestions on controlling for the flushing effect and
yes.
stuff?
The reason that a lot of people yeah. drop off niacin if they try it is the fact that most doctors don't understand how to titrate it, how to increase the dose. They start off too high, and that big dose, you get flushed, you get itchy, and you say, hey, I'm not taking this anymore. What needs to happen is a very slow build-up process. I took 4 months to get up to my maintenance dosage, just to give you an idea. Starting off with 50 milligrams, and you should take it with a meal so that it's not just sitting in your stomach alone. It gets slowed down by the absorption gets slowed down by food. One of the other things you can do is a half an hour before taking niacin, take an aspirin. Now, someone like me is on aspirin therapy, so I have to take an aspirin, so I tie it in with my niacin.
Yeah, although there are some other tricks. I think vitamin C also controls for the flushing effect. Vitamin C lowers histamine,
yes, that
which is
help.
What you're getting is a histamine effect. I'm trying to remember what else Abram Hoffer said. Do you have something, George?
Niacin and inositol.
Niacin and inositol. Say that again.
Hexa,
niacin. Have you ever heard of that, Matt?
No. There is a form of niacin now that's called niaspan. It's a slower release formula of niacin, and a lot of doctors are being successful.
These are
with
prescriptions.
That.
Yeah, hexaniacin is a prescription too. No, not okay.
Now there's some other therapies. Niacin's not the only one. If someone can't tolerate niacin. There's a group of drugs called fibrates. There's one called Tricor. I think it's made by Abbott Labs, that pretty much mimics the effect of niacin. It increases HDL and lowers small particle LDL. Let's see. There are some other non-drug interventions. There's something called bile acid binding agents that can be used. But my point is there are probably four or five different good therapies that can be used to reverse the effect of these genetic problems.
Okay, let me just stop you for a second. There is niacinamide, and my impression is that that's not what you should use.
No, not niacinamide.
Okay. Yeah, because people will often... What about no-flush niacin? That's hexaniacin is no-flush niacin. Okay, now that's mystery's been solved. Do you have any thoughts about no-flush, Matthew?
The way that they get no flush niacin is they put some buffering agents in it. Through the years, let me first say that niacin should only be taken under a doctor's supervision. They should check your liver enzymes. For some people, less than 1% of the population, it could cause some liver damage. It tends to be people that have already had maybe sclerosis or who have had maybe hepatitis at some point in their life.
Yeah, I would think. I wouldn't think that a normal liver would be bothered by it at all.
A normal liver normally is not bothered.
No.
It's like less than 1% response rate. The higher response rate tends to be for those types of niacin that are time-released and buffered.
Ah.
Pure niacin, pure crystal niacin, has the lowest incidence of toxicity.
You know something interesting? Abram Hoffer, one of the early pioneers of orthomolecular medicine, was literally reversing schizophrenia with niacin. In children, young people, young teenagers and young adults. First incident with a schizophrenic episode, a psychotic episode, he was treating them with niacin and it was working.
It's also used for depression.
Very much so, and there is a connection here. You know, they always talk about the connection between heart disease and depression, and they always wonder why there's a connection. And it's like, some people go, well, duh, if you've got heart disease, wouldn't that depress you? But that's not the point. The point is that clotting factors affect everything. They affect your digestion. They affect your brain. They're going to affect everything. Clotting factors, I think, there's a big connection, for instance, between diabetes and Alzheimer's and insulin resistance and stuff. So these clotting things and diabetes and heart disease. So it's all mixed up.
And Alzheimer's and heart disease.
And Alzheimer's and heart disease, very much so, right in the same pocket. So niacin... there's another little formula for heart disease, and I'm going to run this by you and see if it makes any difference in your experience in LDL. The formula is CCME, and it's CoQ10, carnitine, magnesium, and vitamin E. Those are incredibly heart protective substances. The magnesium is a vasodilator, so it helps to open the blood flow where calcium closes it down. So that's what a calcium channel blocker for hypertension is really. So is magnesium. If you have a balance of magnesium and calcium, you don't have to kick your calcium out with a calcium channel blocker. You can take some magnesium to balance it. So CCME, CoQ10, carnitine, magnesium, and vitamin E. What do you think about also for LDL?
My sense is that there are a number of things that you can do that have some effect. There are probably dozens. I mean, you can get into things like eating garlic, you can get into fish oil supplements.
Fish oil, I do. That was the next thing I was going to mention, is I think fish oil is extremely important. I think vitamin E and fish oil are huge.
Yeah.
And there's also turmeric, curcumin, is very important for the heart. So, and
all of these things,
chondroitin.
They all have an effect.
Yeah. What you're saying is this is so particular that you've got to address it in a particular way.
Well, I would say that the bulk of the issues can be dealt with. The most serious issue is the blood chemistry, clotting, and cholesterol all sort of mixed together. And probably the biggest thing that can have an effect on that is going to be niacin or one of the fibrate drugs. Everything else is kind of peripheral. It all has an effect, but it's like saying, you know, this is a 300-pound football player versus, you know, four ballet dancers. The ballet dancers kind of can help out, but it's that big thing that you want in the middle that deals with stuff. Niacin will deal with most of the cholesterol issues. Then you start throwing in things like, red wine, garlic.
I don't believe the red wine thing. I think that's been debunked because, and actually, you know, my engineer is a pharmacist, and he's shaking his head, too. It's the resveratrol. It's the grape skins that are useful. The alcohol is... I don't know. I don't think it's that great. But anyway,
it's the grape extract.
The grape is what you
right.
can, and you can take grape. You know, I just want to ID the show. It's Your Own Health and Fitness. We're on the phone with, I'm Lena Berman. It's Matthew Bayan, B-A-Y-A-N, that's talking to me. Eat fat, be healthy, understanding the heart stopper gene when a low-fat diet can kill you, about small particle LDL cholesterol. His website is eatfatbehealthy.com. You know, Matthew, before we run out of time, I want you to explain why you say that a low-fat diet will kill you. Why don't you be very specific about what you're saying?
Because a low-fat diet if you reduce your fat, you have to increase something else. Usually people will increase carbohydrates. You can increase carbohydrates and protein. That's your only two options. For a lot of people, and I'm talking about 30 to 40% of the population, when you do that, you change the way your body produces cholesterol and the way it manages fat. It's been proven by research. So that you could start to, let's say you want to lose weight and you go on to a low-fat diet. If you're one of those one out of three people, you could begin to trigger the production of a lot of small particle LDL, and that increases your heart attack risk. That extra amount of small particle LDL over a couple of years will bring you much closer to some kind of heart event, some bad event. And that's why. Now, does that mean that a high-fat diet is going to prevent it? No. Again, you don't know how your body will respond to a low-fat diet or a high-fat diet. And that's why I've suggested the expanded cholesterol test gives you some sense of how your body metabolizes and what it creates as a byproduct of your current situation, your current diet, your exercise. And from there, then you can make conclusions. Some people do well on a higher fat diet. Some do well on a lower fat diet. But you need to know who you are first.
Yeah, and how. It's nice that there's a better test, because the last time we interviewed you, the only thing people had as an option was going to the Berkeley Heart Lab and having a $600 panel done. It was really hard, and it was hard to get it done. So this is a relief that there's something a little more accessible here.
Yeah.
I guess what I tell people is that the way you monitor yourself is if you're on a low-fat diet and you're eating a lot of carbohydrates and your triglycerides go above 100, you're going in a bad direction. If that's not happening, then it's less of a concern, unless you're also somebody who has a lot of cancer in your family or maybe even has cancer. Then a high carbohydrate diet is a high sugar diet, and that feeds the cancer, so that's another problem. And then there's the diabetes issue. Insulin resistance, again, if you're eating a lot of food that raises your blood sugar, your body's going to respond by producing more insulin. And if that goes on and on and on and on and on, especially in people who are genetically predisposed, the insulin, the sensitivity of your tissue to the insulin goes way down, and the body has to create even more insulin to get your blood sugars down. Finally, it can't do it at all because the tissues just get desensitized. Your blood sugar goes up really high, and high blood sugars are incredibly damaging to the body. And you end up with diabetes. And sometimes it takes people till they're elderly for this to happen. Some people it happens very young, but it's very destructive if it's not controlled. So the blood sugars have to be controlled to control the insulin. And in that case, a high-fat, high-protein diet helps because it's very hard. It can be done. The body can produce sugar from anything, from your own tissues, but not from fat. And it can't produce it from it can produce it from protein, but it's more slow. So diabetics tend to do better on a diet where it's rich in protein, high in fat, and even the portions of vegetables are controlled. It's an Atkins-like diet, although Atkins' induction diet is not the same as his maintenance diet. But it's controlling for total carbohydrate intake, to keeping it down to a certain amount to avoid this insulin sensitivity. And those are people who have often small particle LDL.
Well, one of the things that we tend to miss, we always focus on sugar when we're talking about diabetics, but one of the other effects of insulin, it doesn't just slam sugar into the cells, it also slams lipids into the cells.
Yes.
It forces the cells to uptake lipids. And this is how people always ask, you know, well, how does this blockage in my heart or in my arteries, how does it form? And that's one of the building blocks. If you have high insulin levels, if you have insulin resistance, or if you're diabetic already, the insulin is pushing not just sugar, but also fat into these cells that line the arterial wall. And as that process continues, that's where you start to get the buildup of blockages. Things like small particle LDL will find those sites. They will go through the cell membrane into the cell wall, and you begin to form this blockage, which is a very fatty substance. And it begins to oxidize, and then you begin to get foam cells, and it's just an ongoing process that ends up with a blockage that will cause a heart attack. But insulin is one of the triggers for people with insulin resistance or with diabetes, and that's the reason that people with diabetes are prone to have a heart attack or to have heart disease.
Now exercise isn't a particular protection for small particle LDL, but I would think that without sufficient exercise, your heart muscle would be too weak to sustain any trauma if something did happen. Is that what we're saying about exercise? But it also lowers blood sugar and things like that.
It's exercise. Part of it, yeah. I mean,
and makes you burn fat as a fuel, too.
If your heart is stronger, you're going to sustain some kind of an insult much more easily. The other thing, though, is that as you make the rest of your body more efficient, there's less of a demand on the heart. And as your other muscles are moving, they are helping to pump blood along with the heart, and there's less strain on your heart. You also tend to lose weight, which will reduce the strain on your heart.
Yeah.
So if you do have some kind of an event, you're probably more likely to survive it. But one of the big things that exercise does, and again, this is mild exercise. You don't have to go nuts. Mild exercise.
Consistently, though.
Consistent exercise will increase the HDL-2 fraction, which is the scrubbing part of the HDL.
Cool.
And it has a dramatic effect. So that will help counter any other things that are going on in terms of your cholesterol situation.
Mm-hmm. So lastly, as we get to the end of the show, I just need you to tell us about what it's like to die 72 times.
Well,
I mean, people have their books about, but it's clear to me that having death experiences is an extremely individual experience. Not everybody's going to see a tunnel in light.
Right.
It depends on what you're. So, I mean, I'm asking this after having asked you, you know, because I know you, whether or not it was okay to ask you, and you said it was. So,
yeah, it's something so difficult to describe. I mean, part of the way I view it is I didn't see what I've normally heard about. I didn't see a tunnel of light. I didn't have spirit guides or angels or anybody around me. It was very different than that. It was an extremely intense experience, and it was extremely real. It was like I had hypersenses. I sensed more than I could in a physical body. And I'm convinced that it was real because of the fact that it was so vivid. I was actually able to think. I was conscious. And there was a great time distortion. I seem to have lived months in a span of maybe 2 hours. 2 hours here, but to me, months were going by. And it changed the way I view time and space. You know, we live in kind of a linear world, a linear consciousness, and it changed the way I viewed the way it all works. You know, it seems to me that there's a lot more connection through time and space, and it's a lot more fluid than we experience in our physical bodies. I was literally able to go anywhere by just thinking it. Now, that sounds bizarre.
I like it. It feels good.
I mean, there was a point where I was in space. I didn't have a body, but I could sense heat and radiation and all sorts of things. And I was looking at a star, and I said, I'd like to see that more closely. And I just kind of blinked in my mind, and suddenly I was right up near the star, and I could feel the heat. It was this incredible cauldron of heat. And I thought, how can I do this? How am I able to do this? And I thought myself somewhere else. And it was an amazing kind of ability. And I reached a point after I was doing that I began to just sort of think, all right, what is happening? How am I able to do this? What is going on? And there's where I literally spent what felt like weeks pondering this vastly expanded universe that I suddenly found myself in.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah,
I don't know how far you want me to go with this.
Well, we're going to run out of time, but I, you know, one of the things I want to mention that the book "Eat Fat, Be Healthy: Understanding the Heartstopper Gene When a Low Fat Diet Can Kill You" such an unfortunate name for this book. It should have been the Heartstopper Gene. Should have been the name of the book, and I know that's what you wanted. But anyway, one of the things that I want people to understand is that Matt is a really good writer, and this book is very, very, it's like reading a novel. It's not like a science book. It's not dry at all. And the discussion of what happened to him is so compelling. I mean, this book, I couldn't put it down when I read it, so I think people will enjoy reading it even just as a book. But what was very touching is that what drew you back was that you wanted to be with your then-girlfriend, now wife. And if you can tell us really fast, because I only have like a minute or two, that you said that it was really painful to come back.
It was.
Yeah.
I was in this place where it seemed that I was just thought. I could do anything in terms of thought. And to have to come back into the physical world felt a lot like birth.
Yeah.
It was as if I had this memory of birth, and it was like, aha, it's just like that. It was painful. It was loud. It was really... really horrible.
Yeah.
And then I was suddenly back in my body, and I was awake.
And now you're with Bev, which is really cool. And you're not afraid to die now, huh?
Not really. No.
Yeah.
I feel very calm about
yeah,
it.
Yeah. That's good. I don't know if it's worth dying 72 times to get there, but you can share it with us, and we can vicariously learn. Anyway, I got to let you go. Reluctantly, thank you so much for making yourself available,
okay.
Matthew Bayan. BAYAN, Eat Fat, Be Healthy, Understanding the Heartstopper Gene When a Low-Fat Diet Can Kill You, www.eatfatbehealthy.com. And we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Okay.
I really, really enjoyed this.
Me too.
Okay, take care.
Bye.
Bye.
I want to thank you all for listening. I'm Lena Berman. If you need more information or if you want a cassette copy of this show or any other in the series, Your Own Health and Fitness, you can call my information number 24 hours at 707-874-2772-874-2772 in the 707 area code. For a list of other available shows, go to my website, www.yourownhealthandfitness.com, and spelled out, yourownhealthandfitness.com. Next week, if the show is not preempted by hearings, you will hear a repeat of an interview with Dr. George Gilson, PhD, about some less invasive treatments for multiple sclerosis, including the use of transdermal histamine. The engineer for Your Own Health and Fitness at the Powerhouse Brewery in Sebastopol is George Curtis. Thank you to Johnny Otis and the Powerhouse at KPFA. I have a fill-in for Lisa Ballard, and I'm really apologetic. Chris, thank you today for filling in. I'm Lena Berman. Your Own Health and Fitness is produced live by Free Speech Radio. May it live forever. KPFA 94.1 FM.